The Brand New World. Part 1. The Pattern. Claire first noticed the pattern on a Tuesday, in October, in the soft blue glow of her fourth monitor, where truth lived in data structures and lies left signatures in the noise. She was 26, brilliant in the way that frightens even the senior supervisors, and she had built something that shouldn't have been possible. A verification system that could cross-reference public statements against archived data with such precision that contradictions became visible like fault lines in bedrock. She called it Clarity, because a great program needs a great name. The breakthrough hadn't been in the algorithm itself. Correlation matrices and natural language processing were well understood terrain. The breakthrough was in what her colleague Bob called temporal consistency mapping, the ability to track not just what was said, but how narratives shifted when audiences changed, how emphases altered when consequences loomed, how entire storylines dissolved when the speaker believed no one was watching. Her apartment in Seattle's Capitol Hill overlooked the city's transformation, the gleaming towers of tech giants standing like promises against the October sky. But Claire had stopped believing in the promises 6 months ago, when she first ran her system against congressional testimony from the past decade. The results had made her hands shake. "You're seeing ghosts," her friend Eve had said over Korean fried chicken that night. Confirmation bias. You built a system to find inconsistencies, so it finds them everywhere. But Claire knew the difference between noise and signal. She had been coding since she was 9, had cut her teeth on Bayesian inference and information theory, had learned early that the universe spoke in patterns for those patient enough to listen. These weren't ghosts. These were fingerprints. Part 2. The Unraveling. She started small, because small was safe. A local city council member who'd promised transparency in campaign finance, then voted to obscure contribution tracking. Claire ran Clarity against his public statements. 17 direct contradictions, 23 misdirections, a pattern of promises made to evening crowds that evaporated in morning votes. She published it on social under a pseudonym, a simple data visualization with timestamps and sources. Everything checkable, everything true. No commentary, no accusations, just pattern laid bare. It went viral in 48 hours. The council member resigned in 72. "You understand what you've done?" Bob asked, appearing at her desk with coffee that had gone cold an hour ago. He was older than her by a decade, had worked at Microsoft, before the latest wave, carried the caution of someone who'd watched the dot-com bubble burst. "You have made truth non-optional." Claire looked at him over her screens. "Truth was always non-optional. We just got used to it being unenforceable." "No," Bob set the coffee down carefully, like he was handling something fragile. "We got used to truth being expensive, time-consuming. By the time journalists fact-checked something, 3 new lies had replaced it. You've made truth instantaneous. Do you understand how that changes everything?" She understood better than he knew, because she had already started running Clarity against bigger targets. Part 3. The Architecture of Deception. The pharmaceutical executive had testified under oath that clinical trials showed no evidence of addiction. Clarity had found 16 internal emails where he discussed those exact addiction patterns. The emails were public, released in a settlement 3 years prior, but they've been buried in 12,000 pages of discovery documents. The system had cross-referenced his testimony in 6 minutes. The education lobbyist, who had argued that standardized testing improved learning outcomes, had quietly sent his own children to a progressive school that refused all standardized tests. The contradiction sat in public records, school enrollment data, testimony transcripts, waiting for someone to look. Clarity looked. The pattern repeated across industries, across institutions, across the careful machinery of narrative control. Not conspiracy, too coordinated for that, but something perhaps more dangerous. An ecosystem where truth was expensive and lies were cheap. Where the gap between public statement and private action was just accepted cost of doing business. Claire built the dashboards at night after her day job ended, drinking jasmine tea and listening to Arvo Pärt while data streamed through her system like light through a prism, separating into its component truths. She was getting faster, better. The system learned from each analysis, refined its pattern recognition, began to anticipate where inconsistencies would hide. "You need to be careful," Eve said when Claire showed her the latest findings. A senator who had voted against climate legislation while shorting coastal real estate. "These are powerful people." "These are people who require darkness," Claire corrected, her fingers moving across the keyboard with the precision of a concert pianist. "I'm just turning on the lights." Part 4. The change began in unexpected places. A high school in Ohio started using modified version of Clarity to verify sources for research papers. Students learned to trace claims to their origins, to spot narrative manipulation, to distinguish between correlation and causation. Their essays became sharper, their questions more penetrating. One 10th grader traced a widely shared statistic back to a single misinterpreted study from 1987 and published her findings. The original paper's author thanked her publicly for the correction. A journalism professor at Northwestern made Clarity mandatory for her classes. "We're not teaching you to destroy sources," she told her students. "We're teaching you to elevate truth. There's a difference." The difference mattered. Because Claire had learned something crucial. The system wasn't just exposing lies. It was making truth beautiful, elegant, undeniable. When she published the analysis of corporate lobbying against environmental regulations, showing how the same companies claiming concern for climate change were funding opposition to every meaningful policy, she included visualizations that looked like art. Networks of influence rendered in flowing curves, money trails like rivers of light, the gap between public virtue signaling and private action made visceral. Truth, it turned out, was more compelling than fiction when you let it speak for itself. Part 5. The Lady Ascending. Claire herself was changing, Not just in skill, though she was coding faster now, seeing patterns with a speed that startled her colleagues, but in bearing, in certainty, in the quiet power that comes from standing for something unambiguous. She started speaking at conferences, and her presence commanded rooms through the kind of unshakable clarity that makes equivocation look like what it is. Cowardice dressed as nuance. The question isn't whether we should reveal truth, she said at a technology ethics symposium in San Francisco, standing before 800 engineers and ethicists. The question is, why we ever accepted that lies should be easier than the truth? We built systems that made deception scalable, ad targeting that fed people comfortable fictions, algorithms that rewarded engagement over accuracy, platforms that turned manipulation into a business model that worked really well. She paused, let the silence build. We can build something else. The standing ovation lasted 3 minutes. But more important than the applause was what happened after. 17 engineers approached her with variations of clarity they had built independently. One specialized in academic citation verification, another tracked political spending, a third mapped corporate board networks to reveal massive conflicts of interest. They were all finding the same thing. When you made truth visible, lies became completely unsustainable. Part 6. The Corruption Hollow. The unraveling accelerated. A scandal that should have dominated news cycles for weeks instead collapsed in days. Because clarity and its variants made the deception too obvious to sustain. The standard playbook, deny, delay, deflect, failed when every denial could be checked instantly against the record, when delays just gave more time for pattern analysis, when deflection was revealed as deflection in real time. The lobbyist, who had spent 20 years crafting careful narratives, found his carefully maintained contradictions mapped across 2 decades in a single visualization. He retired rather than face the questions. The news network, that had built its business model on outrage, learned that outrage couldn't survive contact with easily verifiable fact. Viewership among the educated demographics completely collapsed. They pivoted or perished. The school district that had quietly lowered standards rather than admit their methods weren't working found all of their data analyzed by 10th graders using open source verification tools. The superintendent resigned. The new one implemented the methodologies that actually worked, the ones that research had always supported. AI-guided, self-directed education, curiosity-driven, healthy, respectful, and ensuring that a student can have a future without needing to escape school to learn for real. You're describing the end of educational authority. A critic said during a televised debate. No, Claire replied, her voice calm as deep water. I'm describing the end of unearned institutional authority. If your institution can't survive transparency and truth, it should just lay down and die. Part 7. The New Architecture. The world didn't become perfect. Claire was too honest with herself to pretend otherwise. but it became a lot harder to sustain the gradation. Politicians still ran for office, but they ran on actual records now, because claiming credit for bills they'd voted against no longer worked. The verification was now public, instant, and very undeniable. So they either changed their behavior or changed careers. The ones who remained were gradually the ones who could withstand scrutiny. For the wiser ones, not because they were perfect, but because they were honest about their imperfections and had lessons to show for them. Brand name universities found that they couldn't hide failing programs behind prestige anymore, and what a clown joke that was. When outcomes could be tracked, when methodology could be verified, when the gap between marketing and results became instantly visible, excellence became the only sustainable strategy. The schools that had actually been teaching critical thinking in ways that students can take with them for life thrived. The ones that had been teaching credentialing scrambled to reform, had their names tarnished, and many of them simply emptied. Companies discovered that corporate social responsibility couldn't be just marketing when every claim could be checked against actual behavior. The gap between your climate pledge and your lobbying record was now visible to your customers, your employees, your investors. So they closed the gap, or they explained why they couldn't, or they lost market share to companies that could. "What you've created," said Dr. Sarah, a political scientist at Yale, "is accountability as infrastructure. Not as aspiration, but as ambient condition, like gravity." They were sitting in Claire's new office. She had quit her day job, started a foundation, brought on 30 engineers overlooking Elliott Bay, and the sunset turned the water to hammered copper. "I created a tool," Claire said. "Humans are choosing how to use it." "You created a tool that makes wisdom easier than ignorance," Sarah countered. "Do you understand how revolutionary that is? For all human history, truth has been expensive, time-consuming to verify, difficult to distribute, easy to obscure. You made truth free and instant and beautiful." Claire considered this. Nietzsche said something about how when you look long into an abyss, the abyss looks back into you. But what if you build mirrors? What if you make the abyss look at itself? Sarah smiled. "Then it can't pretend to be anything but an abyss." Part 8. The Knight's Code. The hardest part, Claire discovered, wasn't technical. It wasn't even political. It was personal. Because clarity didn't care about ideology. It didn't care about your team, your tribe, your carefully maintained narrative about who wore the white hat. It just cared about consistency between claim and action, between promise and behavior, between the public face and the private choice. When a beloved progressive leader turned out to have quietly blocked affordable housing in his own district while championing it everywhere else, the progressive movement had to reckon with that. When a celebrated conservative journalist turned out to have plagiarized 17 articles over 5 years, the conservative movement had to acknowledge it. The temptation to make exceptions, "Yes, but they're fighting for the right things, yes, but the other side is worse," collapsed against the simple fact that you could check. And people did check. the young especially, the generation that had grown up with an open world encyclopedia, with reverse image search, with the implicit understanding that information wanted to be verified. They took to truth verification like natives to their homeland. Claire watched a 16-year-old video creator use Clarity to fact-check a viral video about vaccines. Not because she was pro or anti-vaccine, but because she wanted to know if the claims were true. The video, methodical, clear, citing every source, got 4 million views. In the comments, "Why didn't they teach us this in school?" Yeah. Well, they were teaching it now. Not everywhere, not yet, but in more places every month. Schools that taught students to verify, to trace claims to sources, to distinguish between correlation and causation. Those schools were producing graduates who could think clearly. And those graduates were becoming voters, becoming employees, becoming the people who decided which institutions survived. Part 9. The Lady and the Gentleman. Claire met Thomas Park at a conference on AI ethics in Geneva. He was, she learned, the lead architect of Meridian, a computer verification system that approached the problem from a different angle, using blockchain to create immutable records of public statements. They went for a coffee after his keynote, which had been brilliant, and argued for 2 hours about methodology in a cafe overlooking Lake Geneva, while the Alps burned rose gold in the evening light. "You're optimizing for comprehensiveness," he said, sketching network diagrams on a napkin. "I'm optimizing for immutability. You want to catch every lie. I want to make lying leave permanent evidence." "Both approaches have merit," Claire replied, adding her own notes to his sketch. "What if we combined them?" They talked until the cafe closed, then walked along the lake as streetlights flickered on, discussing database architecture and ethical frameworks, and the careful art of making truth matter again. He was, she noted, the kind of a man who listened more than he spoke, who asked questions that revealed he had been thinking 3 steps ahead, who didn't perform his intelligence, but simply possessed it, like breathing. "Why did you build Meridian?" she asked, as they paused to watch the fountain in the harbor, water rising 40 feet into the air, crystalline and precise. Thomas was quiet for a moment. "My mother was a journalist," he said finally. "Covered war crimes in Bosnia. She documented atrocities, got testimony from survivors, published everything she found, and then she watched half of it get denied, dismissed, memory hold. She died believing her life's work had changed nothing." He looked at Claire. "We built Meridian so that it wouldn't happen to anyone else, so truth would have permanent address." Claire understood then that they were alike, not in method, but in purpose. Both of them building architectures of accountability, both refusing to accept that lies were just the cost of doing business. "We should collaborate," she said. His smile was subtle, but genuine. "I was hoping you'd say that." What a jerk. Part 10. The Rising Tide. 6 months later, Clarity and Meridian merged into something larger. They called it Veritas, because sometimes the obvious name is the right one. It wasn't just a verification system anymore. It was an ecosystem. Academic research used it to track citation accuracy, Investigative journalists used it to map influence networks. Teachers used it to train critical thinking. Citizens used it to evaluate their representatives. The World Economic Forum published a report. Corruption was down globally by 18% in regions where verification systems were widely adopted. Not because people had become more moral, but because immoral behavior had become more expensive. Authoritarians hated it, naturally. 3 countries banned Veritas outright. But the bans backfired because young people in those countries just use VPNs, and the act of banning truth verification became its own kind of signal. You're not seeing what's really happening, Thomas said to Claire as they stood in their shared office space in San Francisco, watching the city lights multiply into darkness. You're thinking of this as a tool, but it's becoming a culture. He was right. Claire could see it in how her nieces spoke, with casual precision, automatically fact-checking claims against sources, building arguments from evidence up rather than from conclusions down. She could see it in how businesses were changing their practices, not from regulation, but from market pressure created by informed consumers. Most of all, she could see it in herself, and how she'd grown from a lone programmer drinking cold tea at 3 a.m. into someone who spoke at United Nations about the architecture of truth, who trained others to build verification systems, who had helped create the tools that made institutional deception unsustainable. She wasn't just a coder anymore. She was an architect of the possible. Part 11. No more secrets. The final piece clicked into place on a Thursday in April. Claire was giving a lecture in Stanford when a student asked the question, "But what about privacy? What about the right to secrets?" The room went quiet. It was the question everyone had been dancing around, the tension between transparency and human need for private space. Claire stood at the podium, considering. In the audience, she saw Thomas, saw her team, saw 100 young faces waiting for her answer. "There's a difference," she said slowly, "between privacy and secrecy. Privacy is the right to a life that is yours, to make personal choices, to have private relationships, to exist without surveillance. That's sacred. That's inalienable." She paused. "Secrecy is different. Secrecy is what you need when your public claims don't match your private actions, when the policy you advocate for others would harm you if you had followed it, when your power depends on people not knowing what you actually do." She looked at the auditorium. "Veritas doesn't invade privacy. It just makes public claims checkable against public records. If you're a senator voting on a housing policy, your housing investments are public information. If you're a CEO promising sustainability, your company's lobbying is public record. If you're an academic citing sources, those sources are public knowledge. We're not revealing secrets. We're just making it harder to hide contradictions." The student nodded slowly. "So you're saying secrets are fine, but hypocrisy is expensive." "Hypocrisy is impossible," Claire corrected with a slight smile. "If you can maintain perfect consistency between your public advocacy and your private behavior, you can have all the privacy you want. But if there's a gap, if you're telling others to sacrifice what you won't sacrifice yourself, That gap is now visible. She saw understanding ripple through the room. This is what changes everything, she continued. Not that people become perfect, but that they become honest about their imperfections. Politician who admits I don't have a perfect solution, but here's my best attempt, is fine. The one who claims perfection while hiding failures, that doesn't work anymore. Epilogue. The Lady's Recognition. 5 years after that Tuesday in October, Claire stood on a stage in Stockholm, accepting something she'd never imagined. Recognition from the Nobel Committee for advances in information, science, and their impact on human governance. The citation read, "For developing architectures that made truth scalable and lies unsustainable, fundamentally altering the relationship between information and power." But what mattered more to Claire than the prize was what she saw when she looked out at the world. Schools that taught verification as a basic skills, like reading or arithmetic. A generation coming of age that simply expected claims to be checkable and true. Institutions that had adapted to transparency or faded into irrelevance. Politicians who learned that honesty was easier than managing contradictions. Companies that found integrity was better for long-term value than short-term manipulation. Not a perfect world, but a world that was harder to lie in, harder to manipulate, harder to profit from ignorance. A world that was learning, slowly but steadily, to prefer truth. That night, after the ceremony, Claire stood on the hotel balcony overlooking Stockholm Harbor, watching the lights shimmer on dark water. Her phone had been buzzing for hours with messages, but one caught her attention. A research brief from MIT's Progress Studies Department. She opened it and felt something shift in her chest. The data was remarkable. Not just the 18% reduction in corruption they had documented before, but what came after that reduction, when institutional lies became expensive, when contradictions became instantly visible, something unexpected happened. Everything accelerated. Scientific research was advancing 34% faster in fields where Veritas had made citation fraud prohibitively difficult. Researchers no longer wasted years building on false foundations. Graduate students weren't spending months tracking down fabricated data. The truth was checkable, so work built on solid ground moved faster, compounded better. Educational outcomes had surged in districts that taught verification as core curriculum. Students who learned to trace claims to sources, to distinguish signal from noise, to build arguments from evidence up, they weren't just better educated. They were faster learners. Give someone the tools to evaluate truth, and they stop wasting time on clever-sounding nonsense. Economic development in regions with high Veritas adoption was outpacing predictions. When contracts were enforceable because claims were checkable, when partnerships didn't collapse from hidden agendas, when you could trust that the terms meant what they said, transaction costs plummeted. Markets moved at the speed of truth instead of the speed of legal discovery. Claire scrolled through the brief, her mind racing. The report concluded with a projection that made her breath catch. If current trends held, humanity might solve problems in the next 20 years that had seemed intractable for the past century. Not because people had become smarter, because lies had become expensive and truth had become free. The fire she lit 5 years ago wasn't just spreading, it was compounding. Somewhere a child was learning to verify truth before learning to doubt herself. Somewhere a researcher was building on solid foundations instead of clever lies. Somewhere a leader was being held accountable, not next year or next decade, but right now, in real time, by citizens who could check. Somewhere. Humanity was rising. And the speed of that rising, now that the weight of systemic deception had been lifted, was breathtaking. Claire smiled into the Stockholm night, genuine and unguarded, and whispered to the water and the lights and the future opening before them all. Let's see how far we can rise.